If that Chapman's standards, though, of getting things careful and pure were pretty high, and he was quite jealous of Hinshelwood's fame because he considered Hinshelwood's work sloppy, which in retrospect it could be said to have been in large part, but even at that time Chapman felt that Hinshelwood rushed into print and really didn't do enough experiments, and he would say in his sort of Mancunian accent, which I can't really represent too well, but he says something like, he sticks his apparatus together with sealing wax, do you see? The old string and sealing wax stuff, but here it was. And I guess Hinshelwood, now and then in a hurry, did not make all joints with a blowtorch. He made them maybe with some sort of gunk. Chapman looked down on that. No, so amongst the Oxford chemists, though, the friendliest was certainly Sidgwick, amongst those I happened to meet. And he was, of course, world famous already. He was just writing then the big book, the two-volume thing, the chemical elements.
Well, one other question I wanted to ask was, you went back to MIT, but given the kind of chemistry that you've already done at MIT and been exposed to, kinetics at the forefront in Oxford. Had you ever thought of, say, going to Taylor's department at Princeton or out to Caltech?
Because I still wasn't really that much in command of myself and know what I really wanted to do. I wasn't really sure. There was a very tentative return to MIT, but again, I found that with one more leap in the demands made upon one, that I could do it. And so there I was, and then decided to stay there. The man I wanted to do my doctorate for was Isidor Amder, because he was just getting started on molecular beams. But this was still Depression, remember, 1937. He was an instructor. And he had one grad student, and it was decreed that he should have no more, and Professor Beatty needed a pair of students to run the compressibility apparatus, and so another student and I were essentially told by Scatcherd, that's where you're going to work. He said, you could argue with me, but I think at this stage your basis for judgment as to which field to work in isn't really very well informed, and we want you to go work there. So I was pliable enough, so I did it. I had one idea which was based on kinetics, in part. The old puzzle of the third-order gas reactions, all of which known at the time seemed to be second-order in nitric oxide, was NO with oxygen, with chlorine, with bromine, and I can't remember the fourth one, hydrogen maybe. And people already had looked for N2O2 in the equilibrium properties of NO, but Beatty's apparatus was accurate for the time. It was probably as good as there was, and I thought, let's give PVT relations of NO another shot and see if I can see deviations from normal corresponding states and find some NO. That was the thesis I would have liked to do. Well, Beatty didn't want to do that. And besides, he said, now I have a grant to work on hydrocarbon mixtures, and mixtures are interesting, so why don't you work on methane butane, which I'd like to do. And so I said, okay. So again, I mean, I was pushed, and I wasn't a very, very aggressive pusher back. I did what I was told, in a way. That was German upbringing, if you like. I was scared of my father till I was well over 30, because you know, he was an authoritarian father.
How did he react to your your beginning career in chemistry?
Oh, very pleased. Sure. Remember, he gave me a copy of Taylor's treatise for Christmas when I said I was going to be a physical chemist, and the following year he gave me a copy of old Nernst's book in German. Still have those, of course, with his writing in them. So, yeah, he was pleased. and in the end turned out to be not nearly as fierce a man as I had always thought him to be all growing up. But
Where did Beatty have the a grant from to do that work on?
Well, it's interesting enough. It was called the Polymerization Process Corporation. What it was an outfit affiliated with M.W. Kellogg, mm-hmm. the petroleum engineers. And the interesting thing is, at the time, the person who was interested in having this work pursued and who had sort of came to visit was a man called Manson Benedict. Mm-hmm. Manson Benedict, very famous in the history of gaseous diffusion at Oak Ridge during the war, subsequently for many years chairman of nuclear engineering at MIT, where we became colleagues then later, now retired, living in Massachusetts. But Manson sort of kept, made it clear when he came up that there were some interesting stakes here. It was obvious, well, what he had was a, for its time, a super empirical equation of state, a sort of modification of Beatty and Bridgman with three more constants thrown in so that he could fit vapor pressures and into the liquid range if he wanted, as well as you could do that before the advent of modern critical phenomena and non-classical stuff. And he wanted to see how it worked on some mixtures, and methane and butane was a fine test case. And
I noticed that there was some collaboration with Sages and Sage and Lacey out at Caltech.
Not by me, no. But they were doing similar things in a way. That's right.
Well, maybe it was just that you obtained some samples from them.
I think from Sage we got the methane. Mm-hmm. My recollection is he had a good source of pure methane, and Beatty got it from him. Yeah, that was about it. I never met Bruce Sage or Lacey either. I know that Beatty was mad at me during the course of that research because I was busy reading Fowler, a big fat book on statistical mechanics, trying to learn about the theory of equations of state. And I didn't get too much of that out of the course taught by Keyes, which was called Statistical Mechanics, but I have to say it was not a good course. Mm. And Kirkwood wasn't around anymore, and so I was trying to learn this stuff. And that cost time because you had to get the thermostat up to the proper temperature. I would be reading in Fowler, and suddenly the damn thing would be 25 degrees too hot, so I would turn it off and go back to reading Fowler, and Jesus, then it was 20 degrees too cold. And the data didn't come as fast as Beatty would have liked. But in the event, it paid off for me. I don't know if he forgave me. We were, friends and colleagues for a long time. What he didn't forgive me for, finally, was when I left MIT to go to Dartmouth. He felt I was a deserter.
Hmm. That's far later.
Yeah, but Beatty was an empiricist at that stage. He was not himself interested in intermolecular forces as such, and if his equation with some rules for juggling the constants could be made to fit the mixtures, that was fine, but it was a chemical engineering point of view, and that's what he had been originally himself. Where he had a classmate in chemical engineering called Robert S. Mulliken. Mulliken left chemical engineering, as we all know.
Well, that actually was one question I wanted to ask, was what were the relations between chemistry and chem engineering like at MIT when you got that?
I wasn't grown up enough to know much about it. We didn't take any of their courses because we had our own in physical chemistry, and then the minor that we were expected to take was physics. So I think they were cordial enough. There's a long history of that. Who's the guy? There was a man at Princeton who wrote a paper about the history of chem engineering at MIT.
John Servos.
Huh?
John Servos.
That's who. I have a reprint of it, and I hadn't known all of that stuff. I had known that, of course, it was all part of the chem department at one stage and eventually broke off. No, it was much the bigger department at the time. We all supposed it was number one in the world at the time, whether it was or not, but Warren K. Lewis was certainly there. McAdams was there. Tom Sherwood. Mm-hmm. Gilliland was the younger guy who'd come. Harold Weber. It was really a great... And Milton, not Milton Meissner, but Fritz Meissner, one of the younger guys. That's Milton's cousin. Milton being the Vesco pal.
Well, one thing that prompted the question was I noticed in one of the first papers you wrote with Beatty on Equations of State that you had used some of Warren K. Lewis's work. So that you were certainly reading that material.
Indeed, and several of Beatty's students on the same apparatus, and therefore people he kept in contact with, were chemical engineers, really. Mm-hmm. WBK, and I can't remember all the names. He and Lewis talked a lot. But I didn't get to know Lewis very well until I was a faculty member much later.
Yeah. Who were the people you were spending a lot of time with as a graduate student?
Fellow grad students?
Fellow grad students.
Well, my lab partner was Gil Ingersoll, mm-hmm. Who went to DuPont. Retired from there now. I forgot to tell you one more thing about Oxford. My Oxford roommate for 2 years was Bill Franta, a North Dakota Rhodes Scholar who became research director of the Polychem, or what was it later called, Plastics Department again. I'm going to have dinner with him tonight.
Oh.
In Wilmington. Yeah.
Well, one of the questions I was going to ask you was how you ended up consulting for DuPont. Did he have anything to do with that?
No, in fact, I helped him get a job at DuPont because he was in the Chem Warfare Service during the war. Mm-hmm. No, but Rhodes Scholars things had something to do with it. The guy who wrote to me was Robert E. Burke, B-U-R-K. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know who that was. Well, if you go back to Western Reserve University, there was a professor there named Robert E. Burke who had been a Rhodes Scholar from Oklahoma and taken a PhD under Hinshelwood at Oxford. Kinetics of something or other, done with sealing wax. Bob Burke got very much into, the practical side of kinetics and catalysis and all that. And during the war... somehow left Western Reserve to go to DuPont. And after I wrote the first paper on gelation, I guess he wrote to me and said, through just the Rhodes Scholar news, I knew that you existed, and now I see you're interested in polymers. We're hoping to hire some scientists at DuPont. Would you be interested? And I said offhand, so far I'm only getting my feet wet as an assistant professor, but it sounds worth a visit anyhow. So I went down to Wilmington to visit him and John L. Brill, who was then the chemical director at what was the old plastics department. We spent a day talking, and later they wrote and said, well, would you consider leaving MIT and coming to work for us? And I thought a while, and then I did a very bold thing for me. I said, I don't guess I want to do that, but possibly you'd like me to come now and then as a consultant. And they bought it. Gee, I really was surprised. And I started going to Arlington, New Jersey, where plastics department then had their research lab. And the most fortunate thing, they had just hired one of the first two students who worked under Peter Debye on light scattering of polymers, Fred Billmeyer, whom you know, of course, as the author in the book and now Prophet Rensselaer for many years. Fred went to work in the Arlington lab. He and Peter P. Debye, the son of the great Peter J. W. Debye, had built the first light scattering apparatus that in this country that worked to study polymers, or maybe not the first since Bruno was working at Brooklyn with that other one, or Columbia. But certainly, maybe it was the first. So there was Fred, and there wasn't anybody else for him to talk to down there, really. So, I mean, on my then once a month, one day trips to New Jersey from Cambridge, we got to have some common interests. In fact, published a couple of papers together before we were through. Not great ones, but things that mm-hmm. we both were interested in.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Well,
so, and somehow, so that, I mean, I helped the consulting a little bit and was, again, horribly dissatisfied with my performance. I felt that every time I failed to answer a question, I was sure to be shown the door. Until after years, it turned out that not many questions are ever answered by consultants. In fact, there are always those who wonder why the hell they exist. But
well, I suppose it's having a chance to bounce questions off other people who have, you know, somewhat more a more detached perspective. In any case, well, let's come back to that. We should get back to MIT a little bit. You mentioned Ingersoll was one of your fellow grad students.
Yeah, and Howard McMahon was another, the guy I mentioned in connection with the rotational spectra. And Leo Epstein, whom I mentioned before, and Barney Vonnegut, who's been a lifelong friend. That's Kurt's older brother, and Barney is a cloud physicist in Albany. He's done some remarkable research on thunderstorms, but Vonnegut is also, I think, the guy who really first did an experiment to measure the rate of nucleation of a crystallization, a technique which many people have followed up on, but he first did it with tin. If you suspend the molten phase in fine droplets, why, once you get a nucleus, well, the growth finishes that droplet quickly, but the other droplets can't start until they get a nucleus. So essentially the rate of crystallization is the rate of nucleation. And he conceived that and carried it out in the case of tin in 1930. I don't know. It was the early 40s. So let's see, who else? Now, we didn't all finish within the same year, but maybe 1 or 2 years of each other. Well, a guy who was a little bit younger but who overlapped a little was Ed Kane, who became a president of DuPont for a while. He worked for Behe also. Clarence Johnson, a man who went to work for Benedict and also was prominent in the annals of the gaseous diffusion process for UF6, isotope separation. He was a Canadian like McMahon. They both came out of the West. Keyes had connections with some Canadian scientists.
By now, you were, this is about 1938 or so, I suppose.
Well, I got married in 38. I finished my degree, actually. I finished with the data, essentially, by the end of 39, so I took a degree in 40 and had a second year of instructorship there till 41. But
what I was going to ask was, by now, you were growing up as a scientist, and you must have thought, you know, you were beginning to have a better sense of where the action was. And
maybe,
I wonder if you'd just talk a little bit about what sorts of things you were reading, what journal, you know, did you keep up with the literature, did you begin to keep track?
Well, I tried to. The Journal of Chemical Physics, of course, was monthly Bible more than anything, and Joe Mayer was God, and Kirkwood, and there wasn't much action at MIT in these areas, and Professor Keyes had been head of the department since about 1920, two or three, and there was a fair amount of grumbling. And in any case, I felt I had to go try something else. And Columbia advertised an instructorship in the extension, which was to teach evening classes or afternoon once in a while, but it was to extension students. And I went down and interviewed and got the offer and leaped at it because I had an office about four doors away from Mayer, and George Kimball was on the same floor, and you know, it was something I wanted to do.
Of course, you discussed this in the article you did with Zim on.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
I'd like to ask you to expand upon some of the points you made there. But
sure.
I noticed in the papers that you've done with Beatty on Equations of State that you had extensively built on some of Mayer's work. So that connection was.
Not really built on any of Mayer's work, I don't think. No, I mean, it was much older stuff. It was just standard second virial coefficient stuff. I mean, the polar gas thing I was kind of pleased with because I did that. I started that while I was a grad student, and that's what made Beatty mad, that I wasn't paying attention to the thermostat all the time. But it was really not much of a trick in retrospect. It was just in pulling through a calculation on the second virial coefficient with dipoles on the molecules as well as a realistic rest of the potential, so Leonard Jones plus dipole. That had been used once before in a sort of half-assed calculation, but Henry Marginau had tried enough to show that it was, that it made a reasonable contribution, but he wasn't interested in data fitting, and he never carried out all the terms. But he was a real physicist. In other words, he wanted ideas, and he didn't care about fitting the data. And I was a chemist who wanted to fit everything, parameters. So.
I guess, I put it not quite the right way. What I was trying to get at was that it was clear from these papers that you were aware of Mayer's work.
I wanted to learn more about him and to learn from him by being nearby.
And Columbia then at this time was, with Mayer there and also his wife coming down from time to time.
Sure.
Kimball, who'd been collaborating with Eyring.
That's right. Harold Urey and Louis P. Hammett, who had written the physical organic book and, was known also in analytical chemistry to anybody who had had to teach some of that, as I had, and a couple of other nice physical chemists who weren't so well known. There was a man called Jake Beaver, who ran the instructional lab and taught some courses, but he was a very nice companion. And there was Charlie Beckman, whom I did mention in the article. A real charming, real bright guy from German background like myself, so we used to kid each other in German half the time. I guess kind of even lazier about writing papers than I turned out to be, because he did some good stuff.
And he certainly...
And he trained... one of his students was a guy who became Urey's right-hand man, a man called Carl Cohen, though with a K. I mean, Carl with a K, Cohen with a C.
And Beckman had certainly had an important influence on both you and Bruno Zinn.
Yeah.
In getting you, as you said, in moving you toward polymer chemistry.
Yeah, he mentioned this polymer stuff, and I'd been reading JACS regularly. I started subscribing to JACS. I guess I joined the society as an MIT senior, so I've got my 50-year pin and all that, but... I read the JACS, and I saw now and then papers by Paul J. Flory on esters, polyesters and stuff. There was an equation or two connected with it, but I thought that was gunk, and I wasn't interested. But when he hit that gelation thing, that was like a bombshell, that's all I can say.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the article it was Tom Fox that had reviewed.
Yeah, that's how I hadn't read the thing yet, and a little journal seminar, he got up and talked about this, and then I went and read them. So,
what, in addition to, well, we should come back to that whole series of papers when you started exploring that area. But Fox was there, Beckman we've heard about, Zim and Doty were also students.
They were first-year grad students when I came as a first-year instructor, yeah. But by the end of that first year, they'd just both decided to do their thesis work with Mayer.
Mm-hmm. So that must have been a fairly
And so had Bill McMillan. So, that mean, Mayer had that great triumvirate of McMillan, Doty, and Zim, all three guys all in 1 year. Wonderful. McMillan, to me, at the time, seemed perhaps the brightest of the three. He's had a strange career. Do you know who that is, William G. McMillan of UCLA?
Well, the name's familiar.
Well, he runs a consulting business to the Pentagon on the side. And he did a postdoc with Edward Teller. Teller was around Columbia at the time, too. But Bill apparently really became a Teller, I'd say a disciple. And has disagreed violently politically with most of his youthful friends over the years without coming to blows or failing to be just as nice personally as ever, but he just doesn't think the way we do. And, but he was Westmoreland's scientific advisor in Vietnam. Owen took up a project that Mayer had suggested in which I dropped when gelation came along. That's the multi-component formal statistical mechanics, the grand ensemble with many components that led to what's called Macmillan-Mayer theory. Zim mentions that in the... See, Macmillan started out an experimental problem, and that was an almost impossibly difficult one, though he pursued it for a while. And then when I dropped the Macmillan-Mayer, or at least shelved it for a while, as I thought, Bill needed a problem, and he was damn smart, and I fine, go ahead. And gee, he polished it off in no time.
Mm-hmm. By this time, also, you were doing a very different, well, not a very different kind, but certainly a much more sophisticated kind of theoretical physical chemistry than you've been doing up until now. I mean, was it the interaction with Mayer that...
I think so. He ran a weekly, you know, a research meeting, and he tried out on us his ideas on the multi-component grand ensemble and on the distribution functions. It was just after Elliot Montrose had left and worked with Mayer and wrote that seminal paper on molecular distribution functions. So all of that meant was that I was used to seeing these complicated notations and not afraid of them. I don't really think it's that much more difficult. It's just the notation is forbidding, and to this day, I'm too old to learn too much new stuff now, but throughout my life, I feel very often it's just the unfamiliarity that scares people, but if they force themselves to read a little bit, all of a sudden it becomes intelligible, and not much harder than stuff they can do already. Well, that's obviously a stupid remark if you take it too far.
Yeah. But it was, in a way, that being familiar with that kind of discourse, if you will, made it easy for you to appreciate Flory's arguments.
Well, no, essentially, Flory had solved the problem, and the general gelation condition he'd given, and then he'd worked out the distribution formulas for some special cases. But, I mean, this is a phase transition, all right, and it's one that's based on stoichiometry and tau. And couldn't I make it look more like Joe Mayer's theory of condensation, where the thing happened because of